Welcome to Sate.
Okay.
A podcast about the foods that have shaped Malaysia. I'm Dr. Nobby Leong, scientist, food writer, and broadcaster.
And I'm Philip Gibson, photographer and sensory evaluator.
And in this series, we take a look at the history, cultures, and cuisines of Malaysia. We're going to take you back tens of thousands of years to the ancient lands of Southeast Asia, all the way through to the creation of a modern-day nation. In this episode, we'll look at durian and the arrival of the first peoples. So prepare those aroma adjectives and get ready for sate.
Okay.
So in the last episode, we talked about sate and the myth of Malaysian cuisine. And we talked about how sate is a great starting point to delve deeper into the history and culture of food. And that Malaysia doesn't have just one cuisine, but it has many cuisines influenced by lots of different cultures. And today we're going to look at one of those cultures, which is the indigenous cultures of Malaysia. But before we do that, let's look at our food symbol of the day, the food that connects us with the past and the culture, and that is durian.
Mm.
The king of fruits.
The king of fruits.
How do you feel about durian? Be honest, do you like it?
I'm getting into it. I think obviously when I'm there, I don't know that I trust the quality of the fruit that makes its way over to here. It's traveled a long way.
If you can find it.
If you can find it. And also it is quite prohibitively expensive to spend a lot of money on something that I would not say I have gotten to loving it yet. And so therefore it would have to be very nice, very fresh durian, I think, for me to enjoy it. And so therefore there's a lot going wrong.
Indeed. So if you don't know what durian is a fruit. It's massive. It's like soccer ball size, maybe bigger. It's covered in spikes, and then the inside, once you crack it open, has this like soft pulp that you eat.
Yeah, they kind of look like enormous like orange segments or something like that, in the way that they're that shape, like a kind of crescent moon almost. Like,
yeah, they're like a crescent moon shape. They're also like yellowy and orangey in color.
Huge seed in the inside of it.
Yeah, and it's like, it's really hard to describe the flavor.
Yeah, I will say, once you get past the smell of this, I'm aware that the more I describe this, the less likely I am to convince people that it's actually nice.
Okay, so why don't we try and do an objective description of durian? So the first thing people would say, talk about, is the smell, because that's what the first sense that is engaged when you encounter a durian.
Sure.
And it does have, smells are subjective. There's no such thing as an objectively bad or an objectively good smell.
Oh, I would disagree. Objectively bad smells. Nobody likes the smell of a rotten egg.
Some cultures, I think, have sulfurous eggs that are a delicacy, I'm sure.
I don't think hydrogen sulfide's the one, but yeah, anyway.
Anyway, so yeah, durian, the smell of it, people do liken it to rotten eggs because it is a bit sulfurous. I personally don't mind the smell. I just think it's just, smells like durian to me.
I wouldn't say that like durian is particularly farty in its smell, though.
No.
Like I don't even know what it is. I think what people say, like rotten meat and stuff like that, but again, I don't know how often I'm actively smelling rotten meat because I don't tend to let it go bad in my fridge. So
yeah, you know. Yeah, people use really visceral language, I think, to describe the smell. I think some people get a bit too like Anthony Bourdain inspired and try and go for the most outrageous adjectives that they could possibly use to describe the durian smell. Rotting meat, rotten egg.
Shock value.
Yeah, exactly. So the smell is only one part of the flavor of durian. When you actually eat it though, it is probably the most complex single food, single ingredient, single fruit that I've ever tasted.
I think so.
Unadulterated. If something's fermented, like cheese, you know, you can get really a lot of strong cheeses.
Right.
But that's had a process attached to it. Whereas durian hasn't been processed in any way by, you know, human intervention.
Sure.
So I think it's the most complex thing I've ever had. How would you describe the taste?
The taste of it, I think, there is a definite custardiness to it. Mm. It's definitely quite perfumey in underneath the kind of like pungent kind of overtone that can be there, there is actually a sweetness and quite a floral sort of, I think, flavor going on there.
Yeah, but it is vanilla custard in not just taste, but also the texture.
Yeah.
It's very creamy.
It melts in your mouth. It's lightly fibrous, but it's not like a pineapple or anything like that. It's smoother. I think you described it almost as having the texture of avocado.
Yeah, I think that's
creamy,
probably
buttery, whatever.
that's probably the most similar fruit and texture that people would be familiar with. Mm-hmm. So where most fruits that people get in a Western supermarket, like apples, oranges, strawberries, they are all moist, sweet, and tangy. But durian is not any of those things. It's not juicy, it's creamy. Mm. It is sweet, but it is also savory in its flavor. So when people try durian for the first time, I think they're thrown off by the texture as much as the flavor, because it's not what a typical Western fruit tastes
like. Yeah, some people have described it as having a kind of cheesiness about it, like a, I don't know, like a light, like a light soft cheese or something like that, you would say.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess kind of fruity, but I can't even think of what fruit.
There's no other fruit that really compares. But what I think, you know, you should get from what you're saying is that for people that are coming to durian for the first time, it is divisive.
Mm.
But for Malaysians, it is not divisive, like, at all. But, like, I think when I was a kid introduced to it, I think my parents almost turned me against it immediately. Because the first thing that any Malaysian will tell you about durian is like, oh, it stinks, it smells bad. And what they want is like a reaction from you. But when you're like five, uh-huh. you're just like, okay, well, I'm going to hate this.
Uh-huh, so you don't even bother to try it.
Yeah,
yeah,
exactly. So if you were about to go to Malaysia and you were sort of researching durian, you'd probably almost definitely come across an article where someone's called it the world's most controversial fruit or something like that. And that's when you start getting the Anthony Bourdains and the food writers that are trying to embellish for a reaction in the same way that my parents were embellishing for a reaction.
But I don't think it's a recent phenomenon. It seems as though people have been writing about it ever since colonial days, like when people were trying the first durians. I came across an article in the New Straits Times from 1931. And as much as there was various instructions about how to serve durian.
So this had someone at a party or something?
This is, I think, the journalist of the article, perhaps, who had gone to a dinner party at the house of, in their words, a wealthy Chinese at Penang, when they were served durian ice cream. And in the most kind of flowery English, "My reserves of politeness have never undergone a greater strain," which I think is quite interesting. But the article then goes on to say that, you know, to say that it's like, you know, even revered by the animals of the jungle or whatever in Southeast Asia. The article then summarizes itself with, "I will leave it at that, only remarking that the tiger's delight is the Londoner's poison."
So not all sort of colonizers or British people that tried it back in the day were so vocal in their dislike of it. And some people actually enjoyed it. So this is a quote from Alfred Wallace Russell, the famous naturalist who visited Borneo. And he said, "In fact, to eat durians is a new sensation, worth a voyage to the East to experience." So perhaps this is where this whole idea of it's controversial came about. You've got two very differing opinions. But I think, like, when people say it's controversial, that's really through a Western viewpoint, because in Malaysia, it's very much not a controversial food at all. And I think that the vast majority of Malaysians adore durian as a fruit.
Mm-hmm.
They think it is like the bee's knees. It is the best thing that you could possibly eat. I think there's a greater love of durian in Malaysia than there is of spicy food. I think there are more people in Malaysia that don't like spicy food than people that don't like durian.
I would say it's not just even limited to Malaysia. I think it's also, you know, that extends across all of Southeast Asia.
I mean, as much as I gripe about the controversy around it, quote unquote, and the use of that terminology, the industry has definitely benefited from this hyped up, trending, controversial nature of durian. Because the industry is so massive, exported to China in large numbers, and every year the exports are growing. And then when you go to Malaysia, it's crazy, durian fever. You've got like durian statues, giant durian signs. You can do durian buffets, sort of like an all-you-can-eat two-hour durian extravaganza to try lots of different types of durian. You can do durian homestays. It's like,
what was it, Old Mother Hubbard? Do you live inside the durian?
so maybe like that. So the industry around durian is massive, and I don't think I can think of another fruit around the world that is as venerated as durian and also so commercially exploited as durian.
Yeah. I was just reading that China has imported something like 15.5 billion kilos of durian in 2024, which is a 10% increase on the previous year. So, yeah, big markets. And Thailand, Vietnam, and Malaysia are being major exporters of that. So, yeah. You know, big business.
Very big business. So with all these strange smells, if you like, and these really complex aromas, kind of does make you wonder how durian came to be. Well, it's certainly me. So, you know, I'm a scientist and I love uncovering the scientific history of an ingredient sometimes.
Sure.
And so I'm always sort of like fascinated by the evolution of durian.
Mm-hmm.
And typically when we think about the evolution of a fruiting plant, you're thinking about, you know, survival. And how has this fruit evolved to survive in the jungles of Malaysia? Imagine we're in the jungle,
mm-hmm.
right? It's dense.
Yeah.
It's kind of dark, very shaded area.
Sure. Yeah.
You're competing as a durian tree with so many other species. And your goal is to make seeds and have that seed literally be spread.
Sure.
You know, that is the case for any plant. They want to reproduce and they want to do so by spreading their seed as far as possible.
And when you look at the fruit itself, it is quite inhospitable given that it is a football-sized spiky ball with the seeds buried in behind this huge thick shell and then this rancid flesh.
Yeah.
Not rancid.
So, yes. So the theory is that the durian evolved this gigantic, thorny, smelly fruit in order to attract what we'd call a disperser. Some sort of animal to be attracted to the fruit, take the seed, and then drop it off somewhere else. And so what happens to durian, the fruit, as it's growing, it's got these giant spikes as it's hanging on the tree, and that wards off animals from touching it because the fruit's not ready yet. When it is ripe, that durian will fall from the tree, drop on the ground, and because it's so heavy, it'll split open.
Okay.
And if you're trying to attract animals, how are you going to attract them? With smell.
Okay.
And animals aren't deterred by the smell of durian. They kind of find it quite nice. And so there's a few animals that will then be attracted to it, eat it, and then carry that seed. So some of them are elephants and rhinos. They will like eat it. They'll eat the seed whole, but the seed won't be digested in the stomach. One day later, when they're far away from the plant, they'll shit it out. The seed's still intact. And what's around the seed is poo, aka fertilizer.
Sure.
So that's one way.
Very ripe durian fertilizer.
Exactly. And the other way is an animal like a macaque will be attracted to it. They'll take the pulp and the seed, then they'll kind of scurry away into another tree or something, eat the pulp and then throw away the seed.
Got it.
It sort of makes me realize how intrinsic durian is to Southeast Asia, to the land, to the plants around it, to the animals, and also to its people. So durian has held a lot of significance to the cultures of Southeast Asia for a long, long time. So in Malaysia, in the southern part of the Malay Peninsula, durian's associated with what you'd call like Malaysian Bigfoot, Orang Mawas.
Okay.
It's supposed to sort of live in the jungles around Johor and it's supposed to eat the durian. So, you know, there's all these stories associated with durian. In the Philippines, it's associated with this story of a king and a hermit. So the story in the Philippines is that a king fell in love with this woman, went to the hermit to get some help to woo the woman. The hermit gave the king a fruit that was smooth and sweet, and the king used that to woo the woman.
Okay.
To get married, but the king didn't invite the hermit. The hermit, pissed off by this whole situation, and cursed the fruit to become thorny and smelly, which is the creation myth for the durian.
I see, okay.
Then in Borobudur, which is a temple in Java, the island in Indonesia, there's like a rock carving of durian. And so I think that temple goes back 1,000 years at least.
Yep.
So you have all these cultures throughout Southeast Asia that have a lot of like deep cultural stories connected just with this one fruit.
Sure.
So it becomes this beautiful link to the past for the peoples of Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
The ancient past, the ancient people.
Mm.
And so for me, durian then is this culinary connection for the ancient land and the first peoples. So kind of let's imagine Malaysia and the land, but tens of thousands of years ago. So this was before there were national borders. So there's no such thing as Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, anything like that. So we've just got the lands around. And we're trying to kind of retrace when the first people might have actually migrated to that land. There is evidence of stone tools about 70,000 years ago in Malaysia, which is amazing. But people, I think, are debating whether or not that means it was actually settled by people and people were actually living there. Fun fact, Philip, 20,000 years ago, the coastal area around Malaysia, that sea level was 120 meters lower than it is today.
Oh, okay. I mean, I guess we're kind of talking about the Ice Age here, aren't we?
Yeah. So what these archaeologists are saying is that if there is evidence of human settlement, it's in the sea now. So it makes it difficult to kind of recreate.
Yeah.
Either way, we've got a situation where tens of thousands of years ago, the first people migrate from the north somewhere, Austronesian speaking. So like maybe China,
okay,
via Taiwan, via Borneo, and then spreading out from Borneo to the rest of the Malay archipelago and the Indonesian archipelago. And so the indigenous people of Malaysia, that's their ancestors.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And so when we say indigenous people, we do mean Malay. They are indigenous. Mm-hmm. But there is also a non-Malay indigenous population.
So yeah, in the last episode, we did a bit of a breakdown on the cultural groups that make up Malaysia, talking about the Malay, the Chinese and the Indian groups as the big three. But we also talked about there being about 13% of the population as being indigenous. So what is that breakdown?
There's two really broad categories of indigenous people. Mm-hmm. There's the indigenous people of the Malay Peninsula,
right,
which are called the Orang Asli,
right,
and the indigenous peoples of the Borneo side of Malaysia. We're not going to talk about the Borneo side of Malaysia in this episode. We'll kind of look at that at future episodes, just because the cultures are very different. Just as an aside, if you are starting to like, if you're doing any independent research or if you're looking into this any further, you might come across the word Bumiputra. And Bumiputra refers to both Malay and Orang Asli and indigenous Borneo people in sort of one category. But just note that that's not really a cultural term. It's more of a political administrative term.
Mm-hmm. Which translates to what? Son of the land?
Sons of the soil, people of the soil. So that's just an aside. So I won't lie, Philip. Before I started this project, and certainly growing up in a household with two Malaysian parents, I knew absolutely nothing about Orang Asli people.
Yeah.
Nothing.
I certainly hadn't heard of it. No, I just would have been of that ignorant camp of just assuming that people from Malaysia were Malays. Before I even knew about the Chinese and Indian populations that exist there.
Because I don't know anything about it, because you don't know anything about it, we thought we'd speak to someone who does know something about it.
I think that's a good idea.
So we went to Kuala Lumpur and we spoke to Emily Wong from Native Discovery. So Native Discovery, they're kind of an organization that works alongside Orang Asli communities. They run tours together to kind of bridge the gap. And they also do advocacy work. Philip and I did a tour with them just outside Kuala Lumpur, which was an amazing experience. But if you're like us and you hadn't heard of Orang Asli, you're definitely not alone.
I didn't even know they exist until 10 years ago. So sure, my name is Emily Wong. I'm a program manager here at Native Discovery, and I work with indigenous communities here in Peninsula Malaysia. So Native is a social enterprise, and we are a small team. There's only 1, 2, 3, 4 of us on the as full-time employees at this point in time.
Lovely. And when you say indigenous communities, who are we talking about?
We're talking about the Orang Asli specifically for, you know, like Peninsula Malaysia. In Sabah, Sarawak, they are known as the Orang Asal. There are 18 sub-tribes of Orang Asli, and we work with, I want to say, at least 5 different sub-tribes now. Mm-hmm. So the community that you visited, they are of the Temuan sub-tribe. So they're like proto-Malay, so they're closest in resemblance in terms of like language, culture, and even facial features to the Malays. And then you've got the Semai and Temiars, who are a little bit up north. And so we've worked with those communities as well. And
so how diverse are the different Orang Asli communities across the peninsula? Are they similar in language or culture, or are they quite different from each other?
I would say they are fairly distinct when it comes to a language especially. So it's easy for me to understand the one because it's very similar to the Malay language, but I am at a complete loss when it comes to the Tamiars, for example. The language is very different. It sounds really foreign to my ears. And so language-wise, I think there's that difference. But what really we see is a key theme in various Orang Asli groups that we work with is really that reverence and that connection to the land. And I believe that this is similar for, you know, like indigenous peoples in other parts of the world. So how connected they are to the land, and there's this reverence towards the environment. And some of the stories that they share are actually fairly similar. So for example, the cultural celebrations that they have. So for us Chinese, we like the big one would be Chinese New Year. And for them, it's Hari Nenek Moyang. And that is Ancestor Day. And it's always at the beginning of the year. And everybody celebrates it a little bit differently. So in Serendah, the way they do it is they have it themed. So every year there's a theme. In 2023, it was a cosplay themed New Year celebration. So you had like Dragon Ball folks, you've got Pokemons, you've got Spider-Mans all across the community. So that was quite fun. And then this year it was Bollywood. So everybody were in saris. So different communities celebrate it differently, but there are the core values of these key anchoring cultural activities are ultimately the same. So reverence for nature, reverence for their ancestors. And I think this really ties back into like their animistic roots, for example.
What is the sort of status of Orang Asli communities and cultures today? I mean, how much of the Malaysian population do they make up? Is the culture thriving? Is it declining? Can you give us a sense of their status?
Yeah, I would say that it's definitely not as appreciated that it, you know, as it ought to be, but there is a growing sense of awareness of the importance and the uniqueness of Orang Asli culture amongst Malaysians. So I'm a millennial. I would say it's growing among millennials and especially Gen Zers. But I'm not quite sure about people my parents' age, for example. Like, but I do know amongst our social circles, and in fact a lot of social groups that advocate for the Orang Asli or work with the Orang Asli are of this age group, right? So the general sense I would think is there's a growing, as we become more socially aware and more understanding of the importance of culture and social cohesion, there's a growing desire amongst the Malaysian public, I'd like to believe, of the importance of and uniqueness of Orang Asli culture.
So historically, you mentioned like millennials are kind of aware and appreciating Orang Asli, but historically, that maybe that wasn't the case. Do you have a sense of why that might be?
So at Native, we think that a lot of this is the public narrative, right, around the Orang Asli. Mm. How are the Orang Asli portrayed in media, for example, or how are they portrayed in our history books? How do our parents talk to us about the Orang Asli? So as with many things in life, you know, there's a lot of stereotypes, biases, perspectives that comes into play. But overall, I would say it's a often misconstrued public narrative that gives people a presupposed view of how the Orang Asli is like, and then we see this cultural disparity. And so at Native, what we really believe in is this whole concept of cultural literacy, right? We really think that to change this public narrative, people need to understand and appreciate the people group as a whole, to understand their culture as a whole. And the only way, not the only way, or one of the easiest way for us to do that was through tourism activities. You know, come meet the people, eat their food, hear them talk, and you would, and if you start, if we get our guests to a point where they start challenging the perceptions, like the preconceived notions that they have about the Orang Asli, that's when we think that that tour has achieved its desired outcome.
Initiatives to bridge the gap also serve to address numerous other issues that Orang Asli communities face.
Land rights is always something that is very, it's a dangerous line to toe in a country like Malaysia, but it is a reality. Land rights has always been an issue. Access to opportunities that perhaps better education opportunities, better work opportunities has been an issue as well. But I don't, you know, like we do believe that, or that the spotlight has always been on the challenges that the Orang Asli face, and perhaps it might be a little bit more beneficial for us as a society, right, to really start looking at, instead of the what challenges they face, the tension between, okay, I know that they face these challenges, they have these issues, but then there's also so much strength and beauty to be celebrated, and how can we, in the process of appreciating this strength and value that the Orang Asli have, and really raising that value, that we can somewhat bridge that gap and close that gap. Yeah, so when we talk about the Orang Asli, a lot of times we are very intentional in positioning them, in highlighting the value that the Orang Asli can bring to the table, especially when it comes to nation building.
So there are numerous complex issues being raised here. And while tourism and cultural sharing is important, there are many other initiatives underway.
You know, we are really convicted by the idea that allyship is the way forward to meaningfully include the Orang Asli in mainstream society and economy. So we started off as a tourism organization where we offer tours, experiential learning experiences for schools. And eventually we realized that we are positioned well to help reach this, to help garner support for the Orang Asli within non-Indigenous communities through the idea of advocating for allyship. So what does allyship with the Orang Asli look like, for example, for a chef like yourself? What does allyship look like with the Orang Asli for a research university like Monash, for example, or Nottingham, that desires to do more work with the Orang Asli? So how does that look like for different profiles in different sectors? It's something that we are super keen to explore, because we believe that everybody has a role to play, right? And the whole idea, again, is to be able to perpetuate this idea of allyship so that we can support the Orang Asli, not so much in helping them or teaching them or telling them what to do, but support them in their fight for a better future as determined by their people and not by us. So just because a certain version of the future looks good to me doesn't mean that it is good for the Orang Asli, right? So what do they want, and how can we collectively share our resources and work towards that? So how can we achieve that shared prosperous future together, that we can truly call it a Malaysian future, and not the Malaysian Chinese future, not the Malaysian Malay future, but a Malaysian future? Can we get to that point? And if the desire is to get to that point, really, we do believe that, you know, like, all Malaysians should be involved, and the Orang Asli are Malaysians. And so how do we get there? We work a lot with universities, for example, where a university might come up and say, hey, I want to do a sociology research, a PhD project on the Orang Asli. Can you help us with it? A lot of times what happens with these research papers is that it gets done, it gets shelved, and it sits on the shelf for God knows how many years, right? Does it benefit the Orang Asli? Is it something that would be of use to the Orang Asli, or is it something that we're just using to fulfill a journal KPI, or increase our impact index, for example? So we see this as an opportunity to really, as force for good, but how can we help the... How can we bridge, again, it's all about like facilitating those relationships, right? How can we facilitate the relationship between the Orang Asli that we work with and the universities, for example, in a way that benefits both parties, and in a way that once again exemplifies that idea of allyship? So one of the things that we're super intentional about is, okay, can you adhere to certain principles when working with the Orang Asli? Make sure they're equitably represented, equitably compensated for their time, for example, or their opinions, their traditional knowledge is not taken as just an ancient source of wisdom, but it's really taken as a source of alternative knowledge that is equally valuable and equally valid? Can we, there's this concept called twicing, right? How do we view problems with one side, you know, looking at things through the lens of modern conventional knowledge and looking through the other lens with traditional knowledge, and then, you know, really just bringing these two knowledge systems together to solve pressing issues.
For an international tourist visiting Malaysia, what do you think allyship looks like in that way? Because, you know, the tourists don't
right. live,
but maybe they want to be an ally. What do you think that would look like?
Right. So I think that can look many different ways. For one, it would definitely be to choose an organization that, you know, works ethically with the Orang Asli. So make sure that they're not, again, properly compensated for their time, that they're not subjected to degrading narratives. So narratives are so important. Like, how are the Orang Asli portrayed in the tour pack that is being sold, for example? So that's also something to look at. And also to, I think for tourists especially, what good allyship may entail is really simply coming into a tour or even coming into a community with an open mind and with a humble heart, right? Recognizing that there are perspectives that I might have of Indigenous peoples and I'm here to learn from them. And I think it comes across really tangibly for the Orang Asli as well, when people have a desire to learn from them, and then that would encourage them to share more and to experience more things with you. And so I would say, again, for tourists in kind of like the tourism sector, what we really want to achieve, or what we think is a good step, first step towards allyship, is to recognize that actually I don't really know anything, you know, like exactly what you have said earlier on and how I felt when I first stepped into the role. And now recognizing that I may be wrong about certain things, or I don't really know that much about the Orang Asli, how then can I, you know, bridge that gap, get to know them better, and then support them in what they want to do. So that's always, I think that's a common starting point, right? Be it international tourists or even a regular Malaysian Joe or Jane, like just have coming in with that humble heart and being ready to have your perceptions challenged, and that's okay. It's okay to be wrong, you know. So yeah.
And what do you hope for the future of Orang Asli culture and communities in the next, say, 10 or 20 years?
Right. So personally, I think what I would hope to see is really for it to have the recognition that it deserves, to be on mainstream media. I think that's a big one. A typical portrayal of Malaysia, you would just see Malay, Chinese, Indian, right? And that lying, right? And others. But can we, and when you ask, oh, what's the national food of Malaysia? Most people would say nasi lemak. But will there be a day that we can say, oh, actually, there are a few different type of things that Malaysians typically consume? And it includes sambal kantan, for example, from the Orang Asli. Is that day ever going to come? I think a girl can dream, but that's the desire in terms of like culture and if you want to talk about food. But on a more, you know, aspirational level, it's really to see how we can, as a group of people, come together and again strive for that collective Malaysian future, and recognize that everybody has a role to play. And for every Malaysian to play their role, they need to be given that opportunity. And can we serve one another? Can we love on one another in ways that would provide those platforms and those opportunities for our fellow Malaysian brother and sister, so that we can kind of journey alongside one another and work towards that common goal? Yeah.
And that was Emily Wong from Native Discovery. It was really quite like an eye-opening conversation from my perspective. As someone with Malaysian heritage, the fact that I didn't know anything about Orang Asli community made me feel quite embarrassed.
Yeah, I could imagine so. It's been interesting, though, what she was saying, though, that there is a growing interest within the younger Malaysian population, though. Like, you know, millennials and onwards or whatever, which you fall firmly in the bracket of. So, I mean, it's good to hear that, you know, more like Malaysian folk are getting interested in understanding more about the Orang Asli people and the indigenous people of of Malaysia. So no, I think it's great that those conversations are happening and that there's groups like that that are working away on it.
I think it was really interesting to hear her talk about nation building. So, you know, Malaysia is such a young country. It formed in its current state in the 60s. So it's such a young country. And so I guess it's the question of who is Malaysia for? How do we move forward? And, you know, you can only move forward if everyone's moving forward, including the indigenous Orang Asli people.
Well, that's just it. It's the word including. It has to be inclusive, doesn't it? And even if the Orang Asli only make up, as you say, less than 1% of the population, I think it's easy to kind of focus on Malay Malaysia, Chinese Malaysia, Indian Malaysia, but what about the Orang Asli Malaysia? Like, you know, and so I think that's, you know, strength and unity or whatever they say.
Yeah.
If you're enjoying this episode, you can follow us on social media at SateOK. We'll be sharing beautiful photos taken by Philip of Malaysia, its people, and of course, the food. We'll also share photos of Malaysia from the archives, so you can see how the country has changed over time. You can also find links to give us a tip or donation to show your appreciation for the work we're doing. So head to our socials at SateOK or visit our website, sateok.com. To find out more, Emily put us in touch with Ronnie Bahari. Ronnie is a well-known Orang Asli community leader. He's a cultural advocate that is inspiring the next generation to be proud of their Orang Asli heritage. He does this through photography, video work, social media, and lots of other things. We spoke to him about his journey from growing up not knowing much about his own culture to now being a community leader and the challenges in promoting Orang Asli culture.
Okay, my name is Ronnie. And I'm the indigenous, and I'm come from the Semai group, and I'm a full-time photographer, and I am also a leader of the cultural group. So I'm also the nose flute player and nose flute maker. I also don't know much about my own culture. I grew up in Gombak, it's about 24 kilometers from KL. So the expose of the urbanization so much on me. So after I reach my age, I think 30 plus, so I find out I there's something is missing inside my life. So I'm been claiming that I'm the indigenous people, but I don't know much about my culture. From that on, try to seeking my root and then try to find out our cultures and heritage. And then friend same age as me or even below than me, they don't know much about our heritage and culture. So that's motivate me. So we have to start do something.
Why do you think so many people have forgotten about all these beautiful traditions? Aside from, you know, you mentioned sort of people changing religions. Is it just that or is it other things?
Yeah, because we time to time we try to evolve. I mean, with urban life, you know, and then since Malaysia independence, so we've been taught that we need education, we need development, we need everything. So we embrace all that things, but we forgot to carry our cultures, you know, because it seems like our traditional costume for a guy. They have to wear a loincloth and then some of the a bead accessory, a headgear. So sometimes for people on that particular time, maybe they feel a bit embarrassed. I remember during the 60s and 60s or 70, early 70s, my mom did tell me, you know, some of their friends or some of them, they are schooling in their village. But after they enter in the secondary school, so they have to move to town. Most of them, whenever they mix with the urban people, where they mix up with them, in the beginning is very hard the urban people to accept them because the differences of the language. This kid, whenever they grow up, they never knew how to speak Malay. They understand, but it's a bit difficult for them to speak. Like me. On the 80s, I mean, when I go to school, I went to Chinese schools. I understand Malay. I don't understand Chinese. So it's very hard for me. And then some of my friends always mocking me up. I mean, they said, Oh yeah, sampan chai, sampan chai, something like that. They didn't call me by the name, but they called me Sakai. Sakai, yeah. So this Sakai boy. Oh yeah, I said. But that time I don't know why, but whatever they call me, I just feel proud. It's like a reverse psychology. I don't feel shame with that. With what they try to mocking me up. They try to call me with that the bad. But I still proud with what they call him. But at the end, I believe they try to mock me up. But at the end, they call me by name.
Yeah. Do you think other Orang Asli people maybe did feel a little shame, and that's maybe why they tried to modernize more and forget their culture? Do you think that was part of it for some people?
Yes. I believe. I mean, that's reasons. That's why they tried hard to blend with Malay or with urban society. You know, they don't really courage to represent themselves as Orang Asli. That was before, but now getting more and more, the young generation are really proud with themselves as Orang Asli. They always represent themselves as Orang Asli, because now we have a media social. Me and my other friends, I mean, we are trying to like re-promote our Orang Asli names and our Orang Asli cultures. We always tell them, I mean, not to be ashamed what who we are, because we are unique, we are special.
So how did you go about learning about your own culture? Did you talk to older generation, or how did you go about learning?
Okay, first I'm starting reading with books, the old books written by British. From there, I've been asking the elders. Of course, we have to go through the elders. Mm-hmm. Some of the elders, they have been not practiced, but they still remember it. So from there, I just write it down sometimes, but most of the time I memorize all the things.
With this knowledge, Ronnie began using his love of photography to bring back aspects of his culture and to showcase them to his community, especially to the young people.
I was interested in photography, documenting the portrait people with my photography. So one thing I find out that every culture, they have their own costume. I find out in an old book written by British, there's a book called Pagan Race. So there's a 2-volume of it. So from there, I found out that the indigenous in Malaysia, they have the cultures and the heritage are so rich that I never knew before. So started from there, I did ask the elders and I did find something, I mean in the books, and then I go to the museum. Then I recreated the costume and then asked young friends, you know, especially the pretty girls and the handsome boy, just to ask them to wear it. And then I photograph. Why I choose younger generation, because if I choose the elders, the younger will not interested. Mm-hmm. So I choose the younger generation because they will see, especially the young girls. So if they see another girls wear the traditional costume and then it look beautiful, mm-hmm. they will feel like, oh, it's like a challenge for them. So I also want to wear too, you know. and then getting more and more younger generation, they're really, really, really have the courage to wear their traditional costume.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you really brought back your culture to life.
Yes.
Just from talking, and it's alive again.
Yes. Yeah. I wish that I can do more, but I'm alone. Take me a longer time to discover all of it, you know.
Yeah. Are there many other people in your community that feel the same, that want to bring that culture alive again?
Yeah, I met some of our friends, so I try to influence them. What I've been doing, you know, I try to inspire the young generation. I mean, so try to convince them and try to tell them we have to be proud with our heritage and cultures.
Mm. What's been the reaction from those young people?
Yeah, in the beginning, they have some of them rejected, and some of them, they also, I mean, they're surprised. They didn't know that our culture are so rich. Mm. So after a few, 1 or 2, 3 years, something like that, after I've been photographing the traditional costume, then it's getting slowly and slowly to make people more interest in knowing about their heritage and cultures. And some of my friends, They try to recreate it, try to mix up with represent with the modern way, and they mix up the cultures and the modern way. Yeah, it's really impressive. Like, for example, our weddings, our traditional wedding was it's very, very simple. But after, I don't know when, because maybe after we have contact with the Malay ruler. So from there, we adopt the Malay cultures in bersanding. But after what I've been doing, more and more couple, they have started to wear their traditional costume. They make it, you know, more traditional look rather than before they practice like a Malay wedding look. Yeah, something like that.
That must be so nice to see.
Yeah.
Change in people's attitudes.
Yes. I sit alone and then I feel, when I look at it, I just feel proud.
But he doesn't just use photography. He also started an organization with some friends called Pesantuan Kabudayan dan Kesenian Orang Asal Perak. They run fashion competitions, workshops, all to encourage young people to get involved with their own culture.
We set up this organization without any, we don't have any money with every of us, you know.
Yeah.
We try to make a programs without involve any money. So what we do was is a online traditional costume competitions. So we managed to get 200 participants.
Wow, for the first one?
Yes.
Wow.
And I come up with my pocket money, 300 of my pocket money. So as a presents.
Prize
so,
money.
Yeah.
Through this organization, Ronnie also works hard to bridge the generational gap, running workshops that bring together older and younger generations.
And how did it go when the older generation and the younger generation came together? What are those sessions like?
So it's actually not much, but it's actually building the trust. Yeah, because the elders always, I mean, have an excuse not to teach the young generation, because they say the young generation don't have the interest. So the young generation, I mean, they have another thought on the elders. The elders don't want to teach, and then they have so many restrictions. For example, mat weaving, the works are so complicated. We have to harvest the pandanus after the harvest. So we have to pluck in the thorn and then to cook it, to soak it in the hot water and then soak it with the colors. And then we have to dry. So the process is a long process. This process always have a taboo on it, you know. We cannot harvest the pandanus on the daytime. We have to harvest it in the early in the morning. So it's so many of the taboo thing, you know. So that's why the young generation is always like too complicated for them to learn.
How did you go about building that trust between those generations?
So after we made them together, then we try to talk to them, and then we try to give the explanation why we do this. The importance of what we're doing, you know. We always tell them, how about another 5 or 10 years? If we don't do this, the thing will be gone forever. So that's what we always tell them. We also tell them they can make it a profit from out from it.
Ronnie says it's a work in progress, and that there's still aspects of his culture that he's still learning about, like the food and cuisine.
For Semang, we have a similarity food with our neighbor Malay. Whatever the menu on Malay, we also have, you know, how we share the same menu. I've been asking our elders, why we cook like a Malay? They said, no, we didn't cook like Malay. We originally cook like this. I mean, I've been learning from my mother and then my grandmother. I mean, it's the same menu like this, they say. And then when I asked my Malay friends, since generation, they already cook like that. I don't know why. Maybe we are from the same group or whatever. I don't know. Because what I believe from 100 of years, we have been sharing space and sharing life together. When the religion became stronger, such as Islam, there's a few restrictions that separate us more and more, you know.
So is the food culture something you're still trying to understand, you're still trying to work out?
Yeah. Because like, for example, like lemang, gelatin rice, it cooked on the bamboo. with the banana leaf and cooked in a bamboo. The Malay have the lemang. We also have the lemang. So we don't know where it's originated.
Despite his efforts, not everyone in his community is happy. Ronnie occasionally has arguments with some elders.
Yeah. And then they also, I mean, they don't like me to share with outsiders our cultures. I just tell them, since our young generations, they don't have much interest on our traditional culture. Might as well I share this knowledge to everybody. At least it's not gone. It's documenting by others, and then it's memorized by others. And then one day, our children, I mean, will go back to find their roots, and then it still exists.
Do you think the elders are slowly coming around to what you're doing?
Yeah, some of them yes, and some of them no.
You can't please everyone, can you?
Yeah, true. I can't please everyone.
Regardless of this tension, Ronnie has helped to change perceptions from beyond his community.
We don't have much information about Orang Asli life, about Orang Asli cultures, about Orang Asli costume. So through this photography and through this competitions, getting more and more others getting to know the Orang Asli, and then they started to realize that sometimes what the bad word they are saying is not good, they cannot use anymore, you know, such as a jakun and sakai, you know. It's really positive. I mean, people all of the whole Malaysia, they started to think more knowledge on the Orang Asli. So we gain more respect.
And as much as his community is growing, it's still quite difficult for tourists and visitors to learn more about Orang Asli culture.
Our Malaysian government, they have been promote only one cultures, only one. I believe they always promote the Mamari cultures. I have met a few foreigners that whenever we mention Orang Asli, the first thing in their mind it was the Mamari. For me, I like to tell them, I mean, indigenous in Malaysia is not only Mamari. It's actually a lot more. I like them to know more about the Orang Asli through what we have been doing, you know. For time being, we don't have a good galleries or a good place. I mean, the foreigner can learn our National Museum and the Orang Asli Museum somewhere in Gombak. They provide the informations, but I believe information is not really up to date. So people always, when they go to the museum, they will learn the Orang Asli. I mean, backward, you know. Not in the current modern days Orang Asli. So whenever they meet me, I say they always like, "Are you really Orang Asli?" Yeah, so yeah, I am. But you're not like what we have been seeing in the museum. Yeah, of course, I know. I tell them in the museum, the data and the information there is the older information. I think they should really have to update the information, you know.
Ronnie has a message though. For everyone.
For my younger generation, especially, we have to really work hard, I mean, to really discover back our cultures and heritage, and then we have to really preserve it before it's dying, you know. For our other friends, please support us so that we can practice our cultures, that we can make our younger generation proud and inspire them to practice more about the cultures, you know.
And that was Ronnie Bahari, Orang Asli Community Leader. What did you make of it, Philip?
I thought it was super interesting. I just think the whole journey that he's been on to just uncover his own identity, basically, I think.
Yeah.
And using like colonial British textbooks to kind of like find out about, you know, customs practices, like design and things like that as well, you know.
Like, it's really inspiring to hear the ways in which he's building his own culture. Like, it must be quite painful to read some of these colonial textbooks and have to, like, filter out all of the racism as you're reading this. And that process must not be easy. Like for me, I'm an immigrant. I didn't grow up in the culture of my birth. But I'm from quite a populist culture. So if I want to learn about Chinese Malaysian heritage, I can just read the internet.
Yeah.
I can read other Chinese Malaysians' words about the topic.
Yeah.
But Ronnie couldn't do that. And for a lot of other Orang Asli people, they can't necessarily do that.
No, it's insane. And I think what's just like so weird to me, certainly as a Brit, as, you know, somebody of the country that the empire that ran Malaysia for so many years, are now the source texts for his own culture. And I can only imagine how many, you know, passages about Orang Asli people must sit in the archives of the British Museum or the British Library or something like that, that are just, you know, things that haven't been digitized yet and there aren't copies of in Malaysia or Singapore or wherever for him to be able to easily go back and reference to continue to build his own identity, I guess, more than anything, and his own community, or reinforce his own community, I guess you would really say.
I do love that Ronnie is not afraid to modernize things, though. You know, he's trying to connect younger generations and older generations and kind of correcting assumptions between those. He's updating costumes. So women's costumes used to be bare-chested, and, you know, if you're a young woman, you probably don't want that. So he's been like, no, we can actually make a top to go with it. He mentioned at the top of the interview that he plays the nose flute. So nose flute is a type of instrument where you kind of blow out through your nostrils in order to make the sound for the flute. And he was telling me that the songs don't really exist because the people that know how to make it, there aren't many of them.
Right.
So he's basically having to create new songs.
Yeah.
And if you are interested to hear what these songs sound like, go to Ronnie Bahari's Instagram or TikTok, and he's got videos that you can hear his music. What I also loved about Ronnie is how he's using the arts to perpetuate his culture. So, you know, photography for that very positive goal of promoting culture. And Ronnie's exhibited at the Venice Biennale with his works.
Which is amazing.
Which is stunning. And so he's really doing as much as he can to promote his own culture.
Yeah, it's the enterprise and like entrepreneurship of him, I think, is something that should be so like admired. It's quite easy to sit back and do nothing, I think, but really feels that it is his cause, I guess, to kind of champion this, I guess, or not. But he's so modest as well, and I don't even think he cares about being the face of it in any sort of a way. I think he just wants to rally people and make the community make more noise, I think. And
it's almost like a sadness in that we're coming at this from the perspective of the first step is to acknowledge that they exist, that they have a culture. You know, that always makes me feel uncomfortable and sad for my own, you know, birth country.
It's good that there are people in the grassroots, you know, in these cultural groups that are doing all of these things to just secure it with what they can. And at least, you know, if we don't have national archives, we have the cloud. And so Ronnie can take his photographs and then they will live forevermore somewhere online in a server farm somewhere.
Forevermore.
We hope. Yeah. Not lost.
So a massive learning experience with this episode today for both of us. If we go back to our food of the episode, durian, I think these two interviews almost recontextualize durian for me. You know, durian is this symbol of Malaysia, Southeast Asia, if you will. It has massive significance for the land, its culture, its people. And I think the more we learn about indigenous cultures, the deeper appreciation I think we have.
It's always about appreciation, I think. I think it's just acknowledging and appreciating and not taking for granted. I don't know, in our project, try to make sure that we are learning and helping to advocate and promote. So, you know.
Indeed. Well, Philip, that is unfortunately all the time that we have today. Thank you so much, everybody, for joining us. We really hope that you've enjoyed today's episode. Now, don't forget to tune in for the next episode. We're going to jump forward in time to about 2,000 years ago, and we're going to look at the start of Malay culture. It's an episode called Coconuts and the Land Before Borders. So join us for the next episode of Satay.
Okay.